Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the 5 Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
DRF Sports Forum Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Forum delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsforum. Enter code DRF Sports.
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Hey, you! Come out here on the floor!
Back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Come out of here on the floor, honey, let's rock some more, yeah. Now when you get out here, don't you have no fear. Put your hands on your hip and let your backbone slip and work out.
We're back at the races. Mr. Excitement himself, Jackie Wilson. Speaking of workouts, you know what? I'm going to go right this second, and I'm just curious how busy day one they might have been yesterday. John Nichols, who visited with us Tuesday and was getting excited and was happy to, you know, as happy as you can be about getting up at 4 a.m. And let me just say, I'm curious as we wait for Steve Askin to join us. And here we go, Churchill Downs, first day of workouts. And how extensive? Well, all right. It doesn't, no, it was a little quiet. It wasn't actually very few recorded workouts, it looks like. So everybody was just getting the legs stretched and getting the shed row set up. I'm sure it'll increase as the week goes on and into the weekend. Steve Askin, good morning.
Good morning.
I will start with Theo, who was so cute. Tina said, "Oh, you got to see this," and she showed me singing. He was recorded, and I thought it was pretty adorable. I'm looking forward to this from our own granddaughter.
Yeah, that was that was a great video. He wound up singing "Twinkle Twinkle."
Yes.
When we FaceTimed afterwards, and he hadn't taken a nap all day, and he did it. You know, what you heard was it would be like the, speaking of the Johnny Mathis version, and when he sings "Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star" without a nap, it's Ozzy Osbourne. I mean, it was the most frantic version of "Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star" you ever heard.
it's really cute. We're getting those same daily the little video clips from Rochester when it comes to Lennon. And,
How old is your salary?
She's got to be March. No, it's like March, April. It's like 2.5 months.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that's she's right. starting to, you know, you can start to see, it's funny, you see them kind of morphing from, like a little kind of blob that really doesn't have a lot of definition, and all of a sudden, you know, they start to do things with their hands, and it, kind of the face is more expressive and responding. It's pretty exciting. And Tina, that's the one thing about what's going on here, and I'm sure this is true with you and Joan. Not being able to go over there and see her. And thank goodness we went for a second time, actually. That ended up being really fortuitous that we went a couple of days, maybe a week, 10 days before things got out of control. So, yeah, that's the first order of business.
They actually start really developing their personality. We saw him probably on his birthday, I guess in February it was, maybe late February, early March or something. And just from that point to now, he's doing so many more things. I mean, when we were there, I couldn't even imagine him singing the lyrics to Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star by himself. I mean, he absorbs so much at this age. It's really remarkable, and he's just getting so cute.
Love it. Well, it's a treat for me, my first experience in that realm, and looking forward to not just her growing up, but I'm sure there's going to be more because the two of them, Zach and Andrea, they seem intent on at least a small brood. So
with quarantine, you might be getting another one before you.
That's a great great point, and we might have been anyway. Actually, she was advocating for Irish twins anyway. So
this is going to be the second baby boom in history.
Exactly. Well, we got a racing boom coming up, Steve, and I've been calling Saturday not Preakness because it should be, but we're going to have to wait and see how that unfolds. Considering all these Derby memories we've done, I started to look toward some Preakness memories, and going way back, actually, when the Triple Crown was less defined in terms of the timing, there were a lot, the first half of Preakness's history before 1940, there were a lot of Preaknesses run early in May, actually. And then it started to really, lock in around mid-May and then finally, the third Saturday. But there was a Preakness on the 14th in slightly modern era, and that was Capo. Beat a nice group with Caton Bradar's grandfather, with Ted Atkinson, for John Gaver. And that came on this day in 1949, Citation. His anniversary's tomorrow. Winning the Preakness. War Admiral's anniversary is tomorrow as well. Looking at Lucky, Smarty Jones, Charismatic, Prairie Bayou, Aloma's Ruler, Cannonero, one of your favorites, and Tom Rolfe, who I feel compelled to ask you about, curiously.
Oh, Tom Rolfe was, he was just a little pocket-sized horse. And, it was a wide-open year, 65. And it was really the first time people really knew who Frank Whiteley was, and he was a nice little horse. I mean, he wasn't a great horse, but I tell you, if you ever want to run a horse over his head, Frank Whiteley actually ran Tom Rolfe against Seabird in the Arc de Triomphe, and Bill Shoemaker rode him, And he actually, you know, Bill Schumacher obviously didn't know the course at Longchamp, and he kept Tom Ralph wide the whole way, which is the kiss of death. You can't go wide at Longchamp. They have that fake scratch that they call it, the phony stretch, where it looks like you're turning into the stretch, but you're actually not, and it's a short run, and then you turn into the main stretch. And Schumacher put him on the outside there. I don't know if he just misjudged it and thought it was the stretch. But then when he turned into the real stretch, he got fanned really wide. He wasn't going to beat Seabird anyway. Seabird went off by himself and was one of the greatest horses of all time. But he didn't run that badly. I think he finished like sixth or something like that. But those were the days when trainers, you know, took chances and ran horses. You know, we actually ran, I think, it was at least four horses that I could think of in the arc. Actually, more than that.
He was sixth. He was sixth.
I thought he was sixth.
He was sixth. And actually, there's a lot. You know, it's interesting. It shouldn't come as a surprise, I suppose. There's quite a bit written about it. And in fact, I'll send out a link. There's a SI. There's a Whitney Tower piece. Even the very best can blunder. And it's about Nijinsky, but it included in it is Tom Rolfe shipping over. And interesting. And what else here? This is
he was one of the many horses in those days that would prep for the Kentucky Derby in the stepping stone purse the week before the race. Nobody would even think of doing that anymore. But he did it. That was an interesting Triple Crown, by the way, because Ogden Phipps had never won a classic, and they thought for sure that they were going to win one at some point. But in that year's Derby and Preakness, they had Dapper Dan, who came from like the clouds and just missed. I mean, he got beat like a photos in both races, and he never really did anything after that. And then the Phippses had to wait all the way from that point on to Orb, because the Phipps family owned in partnership with Stuart Janney.
Sure.
But they thought, I remember talking to Denny Phipps, he said after Dapper Dan, he said it was just a matter of time that they were going to win a Derby, and they didn't. They did not until Orb. You know, by then Ogden Phipps was gone.
Well, and that, you know, that Derby, we'll start with we'll go backward to the Derby, and you mentioned, you know, Dapper Dan's rally under Milo Valenzuela and just misses by a neck, Lucky Debonair. And
I'll give you a great story. Frank Whiteley, you know, like I said, people didn't know much about Frank Whiteley, but training up to the Preakness, Frank Whiteley actually got fined. He was stabled, I believe he was stabled at Laurel. That was Frank Whiteley's home base, and he shipped Tom Ralph to Pimlico to work for the Preakness, but he didn't want anybody to know about it. So he brought the horse to the stable gate, and he checked the horse in under the name of a different horse who was like a cheap claimer. And everybody was wondering, why is Frank Whiteley shipping a claimer to work out at Pimlico? Nobody could figure out why. And then somebody finally saw him and realized that it was Tom Ralph. That was Frank Whiteley. He was always trying to get away with something, and you know he couldn't care about protocol.
Well, one just fun. I mean, for me, this was a kind of a fun note. And whenever Lucky Debonair's name comes up, Donata Farm in Chicago.
Sure.
And
yeah.
in the middle of Chicago.
Great farm.
It's the craziest thing. I mean, it's down toward, I forget what that, there's a park across the street. Anyway, I went to a wedding with a girlfriend. And when I was spending a lot of time in Chicago. And at one point, she had to get there early because she was in the wedding. And I went and walked over to, you know, to the stables. And they've got a plaque where Lucky Debonair, what his stall. And it's pretty cool. It's a banquet hall, the family house. And there's,
you know,
a lot of weddings and functions.
Right?
Ada Rice and the husband, with the husband?
Dan,
yeah.
Dan and Ada Rice.
Yeah, Danae.
They were sent out really hard-knocking horses. That was going to be the silks. They had, it was like pink and white. It had diamonds, and it had beautiful silks. They had a horse that came very, very, very close to beating Dr. Fager. Advocator. In the UN.
Advocator. Nice. Wheaton, by the way. It's in Wheaton.
They had a lot of good horses. Delta Judge was their horse. The native farm, by the way, was part. Colonel Bradley had Idle Hour Farm when they dominated the sport in the 30s and they were winning the Kentucky Derby almost every year. Idle Hour Farm was like the biggest farm in Kentucky. They had all of those all those Derby winners and all those champions. And when Bradley died, they divided his farm into three separate farms. One was Darby Dan, one was King Ranch, and one was the Native Farm.
Now, after winning the Derby, he really he did not run well in the Preakness. Lucky Debonair got beat at 3-2.
He was an okay horse. I mean, he was nothing. He was nothing special.
Well, and Dapper Dan was second again, actually, and then he was
fifth
in the ultimate. Yeah, and then fifth in the Belmont when Hail to All.
Had his turn. Barely beat Tom Rolfe in that race. Tom Rolfe probably should have won two legs of the Triple Crown that year.
Well, and you know, Tony was talking. We should include Tony was talking about Ronnie Turcotte because I brought up 73, which was the only Preakness Tony rode in, and he was fifth. But Ronnie Turcotte rode Tom Rolfe.
Yeah. I mean, Shoemaker wound up becoming his regular rider after the Triple Crown.
Down the road.
No, because Whiteley, basically after the Triple Crown, Whiteley raced him basically all in the Midwest. He just ran in Arlington Park every race. But he was a good horse. I mean, the following year he was a decent horse. I remember one of the most amazing races he ran when he was a 4-year-old, when he won the Aqueduct Handicap, where how he got up is beyond me. He made this incredible run in the stretch. Beat a really good horse named Pluck, who's one of the top handicap horses, but he was totally beaten. I mean, he came from about as far back in the stretch as I've ever seen a horse, and that wasn't his style of running at all. By the way, in that arc that Tom Rolfe ran in, the horse that finished third, named Diatome. It's a trivia question. What race did he go on to win?
Diatome. D-E-I-T-O-M-E?
D-I-A-T-O-M-E. He finished third in that arc. Seabird won the race. There was the second horse, Reliance, had won the French Derby. And he was the best horse in France. Seabird was the best horse in France, but Seabird won the English Derby, and he won so many other big races all over. But Diatome was his main threat. I mean, Reliance was his main threat, and Diatome ran a big race to finish third. And to boost the form of that race, D'Antoine went on to win another big race of interest.
You've set it up. Tell us.
It was the Washington, D.C. International.
Oh, how about that? Nice. You know, I'm noting, Steve, one part of this storyline from, you know, the 65, you had six horses out of the Derby. It was only an 11-horse field, and six of them went on to Baltimore, including the top five finishers, Tom Rolfe, Dapper Dan, Hail to All, Native Charger, Swift Ruler, and then only Hail to All, Tom Rolfe, and Dapper Dan went on to compete in New York. And one horse, there was one horse that I guess, yeah, Solari only, yeah, Solari ran Preakness and Belmont only. He didn't run in the Derby, but interesting field, too. You know, and that's, you know, with all three of these charts, I got three sets of charts in front of me. And I'm curious, you know, we've been told how, you know, so many horses, you know, are bypassing legs of the Triple Crown. But yet, I'd be interested to see, you know, that'd be a worthwhile project, you know, to see what years, you know, year to year, how many, you know, ran in all three and what percentage of the fields, you know, participated.
That's why everybody says, you know, I was just reading a piece, a new proposal for the Triple Crown, and saying, oh, you can't, trainers hate running back in 2 weeks. I mean, the vast majority of the Preaknesses have been won by horses coming out of the Derby. And I know the horses today aren't like they were back then, but it still holds true. Because I'm still a firm believer that, you know, a horse goes into the Derby, and they come out of the race on an adrenaline high, and they're just on a roll. And when they come back in 2 weeks, they continue. If you go back and look at the Derby winners, or horses that ran in the Derby, that let's say the Preakness winners, if you look at the majority of Preakness winners, basically almost all of them, I would say maybe 75-80% of them ran better races in the Preakness than they did in the Derby. You go back and look at horses that won the Preakness and the Derby, or horses that finished second in the Derby and won the Preakness. But even horses that won the Derby, go look and see how many of them ran better races in the Preakness. So, I mean, as far as, that's what makes the Triple Crown special. It's not having three races. It's the three races in 5 weeks,
right?
It's supposed to be hard, as Tom Hanks said in A League of Their Own. You know, talking about baseball, it's supposed to be hard. If it wasn't hard, everybody would do it.
Exactly.
That's what makes, you know, to have three races. Plus, you know, I think people overestimate the attention span of the American public. I think people they're interested to seeing this boom, 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 because nothing else is going on in Triple Crown. But if you spread the Triple Crown, you know, from June to August, I think a lot of people are going to, you know, lose interest in it. I'm not saying everybody will, obviously, but I think a lot of people will. I think they like seeing these horses come back in 2 weeks. And, I mean, it certainly doesn't affect them coming back in 2 weeks because, like I said, they run better in the Preakness than they do in the Derby. Look at horses like Funny Side and Smarty Jones.
Sure.
I mean, look at the Fleet Alex. I could read you a list of horses. I could read you a list of 20, 25 horses that ran better in the Preakness than they did in the Derby. Point given. I mean, all of them did. Really, really charismatic, real quiet. And the ones that didn't ran as good, like Silver Charm, ran as good in the Preakness as he did the Derby. And, you know, and he had a gut wrencher in the Derby. And he still came, you know, he still came back and had another gut wrencher in the Preakness and almost won the Belmont.
Yep.
So, you know, I don't... I don't buy that about, you know, that coming back in 2 weeks, you know, kills these horses. I mean, it doesn't. I mean, it's proven that it doesn't. It's proven that they get better. They get, you know, they get on a roll. Maybe, you know, eventually they're going to come down off that roll. That's why, you know, you usually give them time after the Belmont. By the way, I heard you talking about Tajma. One of my favorite, I have pictures of Joan and Mandy with Tajma. We went to go visit her at Briardale Farm, which is like situated in the middle of nowhere. It was like it's like in the middle of the Pine Barrens. I mean, it was just finding this place. I mean, there was nothing around it. But we went to go see her because she was a great mare.
This is
realize,
some.
By the way, that I know you have your book open, so you would guess this. Yeah. But a good trivia question for, you know, who doesn't have the champions book. Tajma actually came very close to setting the world record for the mile. And people don't realize that she got beat like less than a length. Going a mile at Arlington Park, and the horse that beat her set a new world record, which was broken like the following month by Buck Passer, and then his was broken 2 years later by Dr. Fager. But the interesting thing is who beat her. I think people would be surprised about that. So I'm sure you're looking at it so you can see who beat her.
I am. And you know, my theme during, you know, this, the last, I don't know, 6-8 weeks, I keep bringing up, and this is a concept I've discussed with you over the years, you know, the horses that time forgot. And, you know, this era, you know, from the, I don't know, from mid 50s to, you know, probably about 1980. I mean, they're just rife with horses like this, that, you know, people know their name, but they don't necessarily know too much about, you know, the details of their career. And then when you fold in, you know, a race that isn't what it used to be or doesn't even exist anymore, like the Equipoise Mile, which is the race in question. And the fact that she did this, Steve, at the end of her career as a 5-year-old, tell everybody, 11-horse field facing males, and she had just come off of a not such a great effort in the Met.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, she finished second to probably one of the most, I don't want to say hated horses, but maligned horses ever, the infamous Hedevar. But I remember what a gorgeous mare she was. Beautiful. Beautiful, one of the most beautiful heads, and I got a great picture of Joan holding Mandy and Mandy petting Tajma. The thing about 1965, what made that such a special year in its own way, not a great year, but a special year, is that that's the first year after the reign of Kelso. I mean, people were so, you know, 60, 61, 62, 63,
right.
64,
right.
Kelso. And then Kelso Gumbo, Kelso Mongo, Kelso TV Lark. All those great races. And Kelso with the, you know, five horses of the year and 5 Jockey Club Gold Cups. And then 65, he's gone. And, you know, people had to adjust, saying, well, yeah, wow, you know, it's just, and, you know, one of the famous lines back then was, you know, it's not going to seem like Saturday without Kelso. And we had like a very wide open year, and that year, and it was really not a lot of horse of the year caliber horses, you know, which is why you had a horse like Roman Brother, who was a nice horse, who ran, put together, you know, a couple of big races late in the year to get horse of the year, but he really wasn't a great horse, and he was just a little horse too. But he put on this big run of horses by winning the Woodward and the Jockey Club Gold Cup, and I think he won the Manhattan in between. And he won, and that's what clinched him Horse of the Year. But before that, he was just an okay horse. I mean, he never really did anything before that. You know, won a few stakes here and there, but nothing of note. Probably one of the best races he ran, and I think he was fourth to Northern Dancer in the Derby. But I think that might have been one of the best races he ran, and I think he was second in the Belmont, the Quadrangle. But I can't swear to that.
Well, but, I think I can tell you that you're right about the fourth to Northern Dancer, because that's sitting close by. And when it came to the second to Quadrangle, beaten two lengths.
Yeah, so I mean, he's a decent 3-year-old, and after that, he won a share of stakes here and there, but he just got on that roll at the end of the year in 65, and they were looking for somebody to give Horse of the Year to. It really wasn't that many horses. There was no big 3-year-old. I mean, Tom Rolfe was a really good horse, but he's not really Horse of the Year caliber. So that's what got Roman Brother Horse of the Year. Then after that, then you had the end of the 60s where everything, racing went nuts. Up past the Damascus, Dr. Fager, Arts and Letters, just a prince. I mean, you could just, the great fillies. I mean, 69 fillies, you had three Hall of Fame fillies in the same crop. I mean, it was just, that was my glory years, the late 60s.
You've got to dial back, though, Steve, a minute and explain Hedivar to those that are hearing the name for the first time, and why he was reviled.
Well, the thing is that Hedivar, I had mentioned this the last time we were talking about Bill Boland, but Hedivar was Damascus's rabbit, and the thing is, everybody complained because you had the race of the century, they were calling it, with Damascus, Dr. Fager, and Buckpasser, and Damascus and Buckpasser both had rabbits, which everybody said, well, it took away from the race. But the thing is, if they weren't in the race, then there was nobody to beating. Maybe as a 3-year-old, but certainly not as a 4-year-old. But nobody was going to beat Dr. Fager when he's the only speed in the race. So it was the only way you can beat him. And John Ayrud, he really didn't complain that much. I mean, he complained at the time. But people don't realize that John Ayrud was one of the first guys to outwardly use a rabbit when he ran a horse called Bold Nero in the Belmont Stakes to kill off Bold Ruler for a gallant man. And he was strictly in there to kill off Bold Ruler because Bold Ruler had won the Preakness, very impressively. So Ayrud knew about rabbits. And, they gave him that term. In Europe, they were called pace setters. I mean, every great horse had a pace setter, because the last thing you wanted in a big race was a false pace. So that's why. And Ron Turcotte rode Hedivar, and he came out of the gate whipping and driving and screaming, and so did Bobby Ussery on Great Power. And, their only purpose in there was to kill off Dr. Fager. Great Power never did. Great Power like ran an eighth of a mile and just stopped. He was out of it. But Hedivar pushed him a long way. And then the following year, when everybody was waiting for the big rematch between Damascus and Dr. Fager, in the suburban handicap, you know, Frank Wiley put Hedevar in again and then wound up scratching him because the horse had, you know, had a little foot problem. So he wound up scratching him. And once Hedevar scratched, you know, that was the end of the race. So Dr. Fager went out there and went in 24, 48 and change. And Matty Yakaza was riding Damascus, and he had no choice. He had to go after him. And he went after him. He went head and head with Dr. Fager down the backstretch. And he made like four moves against him, pulled up on even terms every time, and Dr. Fager turned him back every time. In fact, they ran the third quarter in that race in 22-3. I mean, that was unbelievable. And Damascus
that's
was a short horse going in. And actually, so was Dr. Fager. Because Dr. Fager had scratched out of the Met Mile when he had a really bad case of colic. So neither one of those horses were at the top of their game. And then they came back in the Brooklyn handicap. And this time, Hedevar was okay. And he ran against him. And Tommy Lee rode him. And he broke from the outside. And Tommy Lee breaks out of the game, guns Hedevar to the lead. And Tommy Lee looks, you could see him looking over his left shoulder saying, where the hell's Dr. Fager? And Baeza was actually raiding Dr. Fager, and Hedevar opened up like a 3 or 4 length lead. And then finally, Baeza couldn't hold Dr. Fager anymore. And he went, he just blew by Hedevar. But he had gone in 109-4. You know, in Woodward, they went 109-1. But they still went, you know, they still went fast into Brooklyn. And the weird thing is that when Dr. Fager won the Suburban, he equaled Gumbo's track record for the mile and a quarter with 132 pounds up. And then in the Brooklyn handicap, when Damascus was much tighter and had his rabbit, he broke Dr. Fager's record, carrying 130 pounds. And that record still stands over 50 years later.
Amazing.
And that was the third mile and a quarter race carrying 130 pounds or more in 16 days. Yeah, he ran in a Suburban, then he ran in the Amory Haskell, carried 131 pounds, got banged into coming out of the gate and got left at the gate, and got beat by Bold Hour. You know, ran a good race, but when he came up to the Brooklyn. Yeah, I went down to the paddock, and you could see his muscles were just absolutely bulging. I mean, he was a horse that you had to keep racing into shape. And that's why he was a little bit short, because Whiteley had given him just like one allowance race in like 5 months, and he won it easily at Delaware Park, so he wasn't quite ready. But you could see that he was just coiled, and he just looked like a totally different horse. And then he won the Brooklyn. Between the Suburban, the Amory Haskell, and the Brooklyn, 3 mile and a quarter races, carrying 133, 131, and 130 in 16 days. And in the last one, he breaks the track record that still stands. So a half a century later.
Unbelievable. 159-1. Was that his last win? So no, he had one more win.
When us old timers say they don't make them like that anymore, they don't make them like that anymore.
No.
No matter how you look at it, they just don't. I mean, if you can imagine a horse doing that now, I mean, the Twitter lunatics would run that trainer out of the game.
And he turned around.
Is, you know, you look at the Triple Crown. Oh, you know, the 2 weeks, 2 weeks. I mean, Citation won the Derby trial. And then came back and he won the Derby 4 days later. Then wins the Preakness and the Belmont. And in between the Preakness and the Belmont, he wins the Jersey Derby. This is running. Not only did he run 4 days before the Kentucky Derby, he won the Derby trial on a Tuesday. And he worked a half a mile on Thursday and then won the Derby on Saturday. Then the Preakness, then the Jersey Derby, then the Belmont, and then everything the rest of the year. He never lost again the rest of the year. So they just, again, I say it again, they just don't make them like that anymore. But it still doesn't stop the horses today from coming back in 2 weeks. You know, maybe some of them suffer the consequences because they're so lightly raced. A horse like Justify, Justify, wins the Derby, off of three starts, which is, basically unheard of. You go back to years of Regret. I mean, people don't realize Regret won the Kentucky Derby. You know what his start before the Kentucky Derby was? The Hopeful. So, I mean, it was a completely different game back then. It was more European. It was more European style where you can do all your training at home. You train these horses. But most of the time you had horses like Carryback. I mean, Carryback was running in two-year-old races in January.
That's another horse that went and ran in the Arc, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The thing is, what made that Arc unique is that Saul Rosen, the editor of the Morning Telegraph, was very close friends with Jack Price, who owned and trained Carryback. And he was a real character anyway. And Saul had him write a daily column from France, talking about it. And you want Blunt. If you ever go back in the archives, go read those columns from Jack Price. He started to talk about all his help, picking up hookers in the Bois de Boulogne. That's what he's writing about. And then he had a big falling out with his jockey, Scobie Breasley, and then trying to work the horse over the course. Scobie Breasley didn't even like the horse, and it was just so much going on, so much junk going on. But Americans didn't pick good years to run in the Arc. C.B. Whitney ran a horse in the Arc and wound up running against Rebo. I mean, we send horses over to run against Rebo and Seabird, probably two greatest horses in the history of European racing. But I think Carryback finished like 10th, but he didn't get beat that badly. I think he only got beat maybe, six, seven lengths or something like that.
Nobody ever gets beaten that badly when it comes to those races because they all run around in a pack,
true.
And then a couple of them, a couple of them pull away late, and nobody gets disgraced.
Yeah, Horatio Lora sent a horse out there, One for All, who was a long distance grass horse. He ran. He was another horse that also finished like 10th or something like that, but didn't get beat by that much. Ogden Phipps sent a horse over there, and I'm drawing a blank on his name. I can't remember his name. He was just an ordinary horse. He was a decent grass horse, but he sent him to the Arc. He might have been the last American horse to go over there for that. But no. I mean, the game has definitely changed.
I've got so many cool things sitting in front of me, including a pair of my American racing manuals, and I pulled up the Chicago Tribune from the next day, June 19th, 1966, and as it happens, Hedevar was the second headline, Steve, that day for the Sunday Sports, because Arnie Palmer had jumped out to a three-stroke lead in the U.S. Open that weekend.
Yeah, listen, Arnie Palmer was, he was a big sports hero back then. He was, there were great golfers before him, Ben Hogan and a lot of great golfers, but he's the one that really brought golf into television.
No doubt.
He really glamorized the sport, Arnie's Army.
Yep.
Then came Nicholas after that. But I mean, in the 60s, he was one of the great sports figures. He was the Tiger Woods of his day. I'll tell you another sports hero back then. I think it was in 67. Because it's funny, I always think of this person, and I always compare him to Damascus, believe it or not. But one of the great sports heroes back then was Jim Ryan, who set the world record for the mile.
Sure. 4-minute mile.
Yeah. And I was compared
I
to
should
Damascus
mention
because Jim Ryan always used to lay back and make a big late run.
I do have to mention, for golfers who were wondering, did Arnie win? The answer is no. Billy Casper beat him in a playoff.
Oh, yeah, another great golfer of his time.
It was played at the Olympics.
Donald Palmer was a cool-looking guy, you know, with his wavy blonde hair and his big smile and his good-looking guy. And
The best part of those...
Most golfers looked like Sam Snead and Billy Casper. They didn't look like Arnie Palmer.
Well, the best part for me, I always get a kick when you find, you find black and whites and you find period photos. Well, and of course, this year with the Chiefs making the Super Bowl, you had the famous picture of Lenny Dawson smoking in the locker room at halftime. And you know, there's so many pictures of golfers out on the course, with cigarettes in their hand, in their mouth. It's so different. And as recently as Jim Leland in Pittsburgh, occasionally the camera would pick up Leland and he'd be cupping a cigarette in his hand.
Well, let me ask a question. Have you ever seen a picture of Red Auerbach without a cigar in his mouth?
No, but you can get it's different. Even today, you'll see guys, with cigars, but the cigarettes have become
foreign to this era.
I remember,
growing up in the 50s, by the way. You'd come out wearing, just a white T-shirt, just basically it was an undershirt. And then you'd take your cigarette, the pack of cigarettes, and put it in your sleeve and roll the sleeve up. And that's how that's where you carried your cigarettes, in the sleeve of your T-shirt. And, if you did that, you were automatically, a cool, tough guy.
People are having a tough time, Steve, envisioning you with the cigarettes rolled up in the sleeve and hanging out, singing doo-wop.
My asthma, let's put it that way. I never smoked a cigarette in my life. But I was always jealous of those guys because they were cool and I wasn't. I was like one of the last new kids, by the way, to go to school wearing one of those aviator caps with the buckles and everything. And I remember I was in the schoolyard, and there were two kids. There were older kids. I was probably like in the fifth grade, and there was two kids like in the seventh and eighth grade. And they started picking on me. And one of the kids came over and pushed me, and the other kid had bent down behind me, and I fell over him. I remember there was this girl there saying, "No, stop picking on a little kid." And I remember ran home, by the way, and I told my mother. I told her, I'm never wearing this hat again. She said, I said, I want you to go out and buy me a stocking cap, because stocking caps were like the next step up. You wore a stocking cap, you were much more cooler than you wear an aviator cap with those stupid flaps. That was a sign of a total nerd. So,
it's like a scene out of Christmas Story.
You had to grow up fast if you wanted to, if you wanted to survive back then. You had to, get in your share of fights. But that's what they were. Were fights. I mean, it was nothing, nobody got hurt. It's just,
No. Occasional bloody nose and a black eye here and there.
That was no big thing.
But I was
looked up to the tough kids. The kids, things. With my stupid Jewish hair, I could never grow that big like pompadour in the front. Where the hair would come out like John Travolta in Grease, and and everybody combing the duck tails and combing the side of their hair and. If you were going to be cool, you had to have that kind of hair, and I didn't. I had the stupid curly hair, that made me look
well. The little Jufro.
You had the little. You know, yeah, but you know, I had a baby face back then. I was short, so I had, you know, I had to had to make my way until I actually grew up.
Steve, too funny, as always. I mean, I didn't have anything defined for you, but I knew we would find interesting and some entertaining topics. And these last few weeks with the Derby memories, particularly, then I have the Hall of Fame conversations, including, I want to, by the way, I haven't thanked yet this morning, Heathley Bell, for a really wonderful 45-minute visit yesterday. And
Heathley Bell, I like him.
Yeah. Really good. Really enjoyed that. And I've had Reynolds and I'd had Doc Chandler, but the opportunity to have Heathley on was irresistible. But, there's so much of this, and there's that's underutilized. And in fact, did you hear Blue? Did you hear Blue yesterday? He was,
well, I got to tell,
he loves
tell you
listening to
by the way. If somebody doesn't want to go through all the trouble of using his recipe for crab cakes, all they have to do is go to the Prime Rib in Baltimore, who has crab cakes in the world, and that's Blue's recipe.
Correct. That we talked a lot because I had not realized until day before yesterday that Buzz Baylor had passed away in November.
Oh, I didn't know that. Really? Wow.
Yeah. Buzz died November, and he'd gotten very sick with Alzheimer's very sad at the end. And
he opened up. He
amazing
wound up
guy.
A few of those, but the Prime Rib in Baltimore still maybe the greatest restaurant I've ever eaten in. I mean, there's just, I can't tell you how many times I ate there with Joe Hirsch and, in the later years, I've told you little stories with Joe Durso and stuff like that.
Sure.
But I mean, with meeting Joe there, I mean, if you ask me what my greatest memory was covering the Triple Crown, it would be, going with Ed and meeting Joe for dinner. At Prime Rib. I mean, it was just the best thing. I'm a vegetarian. I'm telling you, that crab cakes, Blue's crab cakes, it was the greatest crab cakes still to this day.
That's all I get there. That's all I get there.
What's that?
That's all I get there. I have to. That's all I'll eat there.
Their corn and their
the potatoes, the potato skins. What about the potato skins?
Yeah, it was a Greenbergs or Greenfields or something.
Greenbergs, yeah.
Greenbergs,
yeah.
Potato skins. It's just the greatest restaurant, and you had to get dressed up. All the maid of these were tuxedos and but that was Joe just absolutely loved that place. God, I love
Steve.
I missed that place so much. I was just those were great days, I tell you. But,
and of course, Steve, you gotta remind everybody before we leave, you gotta have dessert. Why?
It wouldn't hurt a baby.
It wouldn't hurt a baby.
You did not go out to eat with Joe Hirsch without having dessert. You had to have dessert.
Yep.
When you went out with Joe, you weren't just going out to eat with Joe. You were his date. And Joe, it was like the greatest honor at the time to go out with Joe. But he treated guys as if they were his date. And you had to have dessert. If there was like eight things on the menu that you couldn't decide on, Joe would go, get them all. I said, well, he would have the waiter just bring everything you wanted.
So great! I'm gonna put up a picture with Joe from Baltimore. I've got a couple of terrific ones actually, and several of those black and whites that I've got. I put them up. People go crazy, Steve. They just love those pictures that from upstairs. I'm gonna have to wait until tough to wait until the fall this year. It's such a crazy situation.
There's Joe's famous line, by the way, and I forgot who it was, but somebody was going to a restaurant, and they mentioned to Joe. They said, "Joe, we're going to so and so's restaurant." And Joe, he said, "You know anything about it?" And Joe says, "Yes, I ate there once." He goes, "Oh, really?" He says, "How did you like it?" And Joe says, "As I said, I ate there once." That was Joe's big line. That was the way. But he always had his favorite places. It was always Hassenauer's at Louisville. Got there, we always meet Joe at Hassenauer's. He always had some. Jim McKay would be there, and he'd always have some big guests, and always eating Hassenauer's. Then it was prime rib in Baltimore.
I talked yesterday with Blue
about whenever you went down to
Miami,
Gulfstream.
Yep, or Hialeah.
Or Hialeah, yeah.
Steve, have a great not Preakness Saturday, and we will convene next
year.
Yeah,
I miss. The thing is, every time I think of Preakness, I think of I remember the early days. You know, I used to love. You know, Preakness was the greatest race to cover. I mean, it was the most fun. Always miss that. You know, you just walk around that same barn and get one story after another. It was great, and it had a little hospitality room at the end, and going down a Little Italy, you know, I always have Sabatino's, something going down with Nick. Nick used to go into Little Italy all the time, eating out with him. Do you realize Ed and I once had dinner with Nick Zito and Bob Baffert? That was quite an interesting night. But, Little Italy, and, of course, Joe's, prime rib. And I was, if you wanted to eat, going on Reisterstown Road, they had all those Jewish bakeries and delis and Knish places on Reisterstown Road.
There was an Atman's on the other side of the Beltway. Atman's had a location right before the... I've talked about this. I covered.
Well, we stayed there on Reisterstown Road right before the Beltway. It was like a Hyatt or a Hilton or one of those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where we used to stay. And right before you got to the hotel, there was a phenomenal Jewish bakery that I would go in there with Lenny. And there was a place. There was a Jewish deli that was all mostly Canisius. I used to stock up on Canisius. to me, you people say your memorable Triple Crowns. My memorable Triple Crowns are eating.
Exactly. I can identify I without a doubt.
Yeah, I mean, that's what was fun. It was fun, by the way, during the day. You say, okay, where are we going to eat tonight? Who are we eating with tonight? And
exactly. Making those arrangements.
In Baltimore, Joe used to have an outing. And if you got invited, it was like the biggest honor. And he used to invite maybe a dozen reporters to a place called Captain Harvey's. And they would bring out everything. I mean, crab soup, crab cakes, hard shell crabs. Watching Joe bang these things open with a hammer, was a sight in itself. But he would have a long table and they would bring out just everything. It was just like a crab fest. And it was all reporters, Ed Schuyler and from AP and Ed and me and just guys from every major newspaper were there. That was Joe's big outing. He'd invite all the media out to Captain Harvey's.
Well, Steve, I've got Dean and Patty Reeves. They are in the car on the way from Georgia down to Florida. I'm going to have them visit, talk to the ages. Yeah.
Still So if you ask me my most memorable Breeders' Cup Classic moment, Mucho Macho Man, that whole story was still maybe one of the great stories ever wrote about.
Yep.
Absolutely love that. I mean, that was just an amazing story, how they got the horse and just the whole thing with the horse. You know, when they thought the horse was born dead, and then Kathy Ridfro was almost dead, you know, from her heart ailment, and yep. How they both came back and found each other, and how Dean and Patty came to buy this horse, you know, when they were looking for a different horse to buy, and they picked the horse up in a second instead of the horse that they were gonna buy originally. But they're great people. It's good to see them having a lot of good horses the last few years too.
Yeah. They really have become just such a fixture and one of some of our favorites. And, you know, one part of that story that you should also include is Carol Rio, who bred him.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Her fascinating story.
She was showing her dogs. She was, because she showed dogs, and she got a call saying that that the foal had been born dead out in the field.
Yep.
And she was like hysterical, and she came driving back to the farm, and they all stood around, and this foal was laying dead in the field, and they all stood around, and Carol Rio was crying, and it was terrible, and just like that, the foal just jumped to his feet and started running around the field. That was Mucho Macho Man.
and the rest is history.
An incredible story.
Unbelievable.
You know, and then if you saw the horse, by the way, just being around him, he was so charismatic. He was a giant of a horse, great disposition. And I tell you, one of the great moments of my career, I had come up with the statistic that when Mucho Macho Man did not have the lead at the eighth pole, he was 0-14. And when he did have the lead at the eighth pole, he was 8-8. And I wrote that down. And then after Gary Stevens came over after the race and, you know, gave the post-race interview, and then it was open, and I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he smiled, and he goes, "Thank you." He says, "I just want to tell you," he says, "when I got to the quarter pole, I was thinking of you." I said, "I got to get that horse to the lead at the eighth pole, whatever I do." And he did. But that was great. I mean, you know, to think that Gary Stevens was thinking of me and my statistic, you know, that, you know, he had to get, he said, I have to get that horse to the lead at the eighth pole, whatever I do.
Exactly.
But that
well,
was,
and we've got, let me.
You know, that was just great, you know, watching Kathy Ridfro watch the replay of the races. If, you know, at the time, nobody really knew who won. It was so close. And she was watching the race, and she's cheering the horse on like she was watching it for the first time.
like it was like
replay.
There was going to be a question, exactly.
Yeah. And then when the horse won, she went running over because I watched the race with her by the rail, and she raced over there. She did like a 40-yard dash over to the horse, and you just think of what not that long, you know, before that, where she couldn't even get out of bed. I mean, she basically was dying. I mean, she had such a bad heart ailment, and how she, and yep. It was amazing how she recovered from that. It's just the paralleling stories of her and the horse itself, forgetting about, you know, with Dean and Patty buying the horse, but the parallel stories between the two. And, you know, Tim actually trained that horse.
At the beginning, that's right, at the beginning.
Before he got the job at Gulfstream Park. And then, you know, they turned her over to Cassie. But, you know, she was, that was just a great, great story. One of my favorite stories ever, I've ever covered.
Well, and let's get Dean and Patty on here, Steve, and I appreciate it. Let me
spend
the last 15 minutes. Well, they're listening, so they know you said hi.
Okay. Hi, guys. Have a good drive.
Steve Askin with a terrific hour, and Dean and Patty Reeves, they've been listening all morning. As soon as they were able to find the right channel, they were kicking around the dial and finally found 201 on the XM side. Dean and Patty, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Steve? Steve? Both Steves? How are y'all?
I think we lost Steve, but
I guess okay.
We could. Well, trust us. If you wouldn't be able to say three words at this point. He's been rolling for 45 minutes, so we want to hear from you guys. Where are you headed? You left Atlanta and heading down to Florida.
Yes, we're going to stop at Ocala, check on some of the babies there, the 2-year-olds that are getting ready to get shipped out to different spots and different trainers, and then on down to Gulfstream Park and probably just hang around. Don't know if we'll get in there to see any races, but we needed to get down there and check on things, and so it worked out to go to Ocala and then on down to Aventura area.
Nice. Where do you keep the babies at Ocala? Who looks after them? Who develops the young horses?
Jimmy Gladwell takes care of them for us. Okay. He just does a super job. He and his daughter, Nellie, and got a good crew there, and they just do a wonderful job. Jimmy and Martha are great folks and great horsemen.
Dean, I'm curious, when it comes to the young horses this year, I mean, have you just kind of treaded water and kept them there? How many of them would already be at racetracks if we hadn't gone through this situation?
Yeah, we've just slowed the whole process down, just taking our time, and backed it up because we just don't know. Now, we've shipped a couple of them out, but for the most part, most of them are still in Ocala. So, I think we're just sort of like everybody else. We just wait to see as these tracks open what we can do and where we can send some of these horses. But you don't want to get them, there's no need in pushing them now if there's, like trying to get them ready for Saratoga if we don't know what the dates are.
Well, and I mean, obviously there's going to be some racing and they're going to race, somewhere. But it does seem like, the whole 2-year-old, the whole 2-year-old program, unless you've got a pronounced presence in South Florida. And we still have only had, I think, maybe seven or eight 2-year-old races. So, we'll see. This may even be of benefit. It's hard to know. How many of your 2-year-olds this year, how many yearlings did you buy and turn over, and then how many homebreds?
Yeah, we had about 4 or 5 homebreds, and then we bought some weanlings, several Mucho Macho Man weanlings. So now they are now 2-year-olds because I was back 2 years ago, I was able to get those at a pretty good price. And I just have always been very confident in him as a stallion. So he's proved to be, a good stallion. And so we've got a good many Mucho Macho Mans that are 2-year-olds now. We've sent a couple to Kathy already. And then we bought some New York breds because Patty and I spent a lot of time in the summers up in New York.
Sure.
It's a great program. So we bought some yearlings at the New York sale and the select sale up in New York. And so those New York breds have been sent to Christoph Clement and George and Danny Gargan. So we're spreading it out, and we're getting some horses to run in the jurisdictions. I guess we feel like that they'll be the most successful. And, with City Man last year, it was just great having a New York bred up there, and those purses are fantastic for those races and those stakes races that are New York bred.
Well, and it's interesting because you've acquired horses and in all different formats. I mean, Steve obviously alluding to buying Mucho Macho Man just as his career had started, and you've also bought more ready-made or bought into some ready-made horses. Any 2-year-old in training sale interest this year? We got a couple of sales now coming up. Got the 2-year-old in training season kind of truncated over the next 6 weeks, give or take. You're going to shop there at all?
Oh yeah, I'm locked and loaded. I mean, I've got the room reservation in Ocala for that sale that first part of June, and I think there's going to be some good buying opportunities, and I think there's going to be some nice horses there for sale. So I'm glad to see those sales get underway, and I suspect we'll be back for the Fazzik Tipton sale and those in July.
That's you know one of the reasons you guys are just so much fun to you know to be with you. You just love the game, and you've had you know such a presence. You know it's hard, Dean. You know, talk a little bit about you know having the kind of success you have with a Breeders' Cup Classic winner and Mucho Macho Man, and then not that you're trying necessarily to replicate that, but still it is hard to you know to duplicate those kinds of successes.
Oh, it's you know you don't realize how hard it is until it's been about 5 years and you hadn't even won a stakes race. So that sort of lets you know how blessed you were and how fortunate to get a horse like Mucho Macho Man. But, you know, we've enjoyed the challenge. You know, Randy Hill and I bought a lot of horses together. We just enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. We've got some other great partners. And, you know, I enjoy buying horses ready-made that people have done a good job picking horses out and got them ready. Sometimes we've found a lot of new partnerships and people we wouldn't have known otherwise. And so that's another, you know, part of the business that I enjoy, looking around and finding those type horses. And we've got two of them that, you know, we bought last year that are going to be in the Roar on Saturday going head-to-head with each other. But, hey, you know, that's fun. Put two of them in the same race and hope we can get there for a win.
Well, and talk a little bit about the current situation. And Patty says, Patty wrote me a text that says, you know, she's trapped in the car with you, and all you're talking about is the Derby point system. That you're not happy.
Well, you know, Churchill can. They're in charge of that, and they can do whatever it is that they want to. But you know, when they start doubling up every time there's going to be a race, and you have the Louisiana Derby, and suddenly, you know, there's a 500 points on the line, and then you go to Arkansas, and there's another 200 or 300 points out there available. We work really hard early in the year to prepare horses for those races that are early, and there are some of them are 20-point races for the winner. Well, you go in there and spend the time with your horse to get to those races and win those races, and then a horse that can finish fourth in a race a month and a half later gets more points, it's a little frustrating. So, you know, the points are supposed to be like gold to me. And then when there are, in the past, we've known what those races were and what the points took for us to get into the Derby. Well, gee, now, I mean, they've, even prior to the Derby, had it been on schedule, you know, with Louisiana, they doubled up on the points. And I just think then it really makes it tough for it to be the 20 best horses in the race.
No, I get it. I get it. Of course, you know, the scenario we're dealing with here is just so, you know, it's so unusual and so unforeseen. Talk about these two horses that, you know, that Kathy is both training, and Our Nation on Parade, who had that tough incident in the allowance try going back, it's got to be, 3 weeks by now. And then there's also the Double Crown, the nice Bourbon Courage gelding that chased home Hopcat, and looks like there's a nice future. Lacey Gaudette introduced that one at Laurel last fall.
Yeah, Lacey did a great job with him, and Bernie Houghton did a great job with Our Nation on Parade. And you know, you can't write these things up or make it up. I mean, my horse loses the jockey, and the only horse he interferes with is my other horse in the race. So, you know, that was just a double tough break for that race. But I thought Double Crown, you know, closed so well that I was pretty happy with that. And, you know, those things happen. You can't help it. But hopefully they can stay out of each other's way Saturday. And I think it'll be a great race. And it's some good competition for us to find out how do they stack up. And I think both those horses are going to be a lot of fun. I think Double Crown at the end of the day probably will be a little better with some more distance. But we needed to get a little bit better race underneath him. And I like this 6.5 rather than him going into the mile race to let him get that going. And then we'll stretch him out from there probably.
Well, we'll talk to Mike Welch tomorrow. This race ended up drawing Green Light Go, who we've been kind of waiting on since the swale. And Jimmy's going to add Lasix for the first time for the Saratoga Special winner and see if he is going to try to reboot his season. And pretty much everybody, Dean, is in this, you know, same situation. At least there's been continuity down in South Florida. Then, of course, what's going on with Randy and you know, some of the others that Tax and who else? Who else is out there that is aiming for stuff?
Well, Tax, we're going to give a couple of months off because we felt like he ran a big race. I thought that over in Arkansas, and then.
Yeah, he ran well.
You know, and I think he needed a little bit of a break, and it's not anything we were really pointing to. So, but he's doing fantastic. Randy and I've got a really nice Constitution colt that we've got with Danny, and we've also got a really nice filly we bought in New York by Run Happy. So really happy to see those two come along. And then we've got several with George Weaver that we're excited about. We've got another Distorted Humor two-year-old that George tells us is doing really well. So I'm going to see them this weekend. And then, of course, you know, I've got Soleil Volante that's sitting ready to go.
Forgot about him.
You know, I mean, and back to the point, Traces, I was happy to see that, you know, that this summer it'll be very exciting to – that Churchill put some points back out there for everybody to chase on. And I think at the end of the day, there's plenty of points. If you deserve being in the Derby, the points are there for you to get to it, to those races. So, you know, I think for Soleil Volante, you know, maybe right now the race at Keeneland may be a spot for him. But we are kind of hoping that Belmont will open, and I think we'd, our preference right now, if it was the latter part of June, we'd like to go to the Belmont, you know, and run there. So, you know, so and then, you know, I've got three good horses with Christophe Clement that are sitting on go that Phil Glorious is about back ready to go. And we've got Hotsy Totsy and Madeline Must, a nice horse we bought over in Europe last year. And then City Man, he's already in New York, and he's about ready to go.
Dane, you, and then there's the two-year-olds you're going to buy. You're out of
exactly.
control.
it's always great. Yeah, so we're ready to go. Let's go, man. I'm dying over here. I mean, I've been at the house. I painted all the railings. I've cleaned the garage. I mean, I'm about done with the house.
You've had enough. I think there's a lot of people in the same frame of mind. Best to Patty, and so great.
So,
I love it, Dean. Drive careful, safe travels. Good luck the rest of the way, and I will see you soon enough and talk again soon.
That'd be great, Steve. Good talking to you. Take care.
Dean and Patty's, Pat, I couldn't tell if Dean's driving or if Patty's driving, but it's always great to connect with the Reeveses. It's such a wonderful addition to the landscape. Steve Haskin today, Tony Black and Dick Powell. You know what? We'll get Rich, you know, Rich Eng. Obviously, his selections will be back. We'll be back tomorrow at racedaylasvegas.com for Santa Anita. Golden Gate action today, and back with the weekend preview tomorrow. Good luck if you're playing, everybody. Talk to you in the morning.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
you are racing two-year-olds in California, Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Here in Pennsylvania, we have the best breeding program in the country, thanks in part to our Racehorse Development Trust Fund. It's a trust, it's not tax dollars, and by law, our fund is completely protected. These are difficult days for all of us. When life in America gets back to normal, and it will, our PA breeding program will be here, stronger and better than ever. To learn more about how we're protecting the trust, go to PABred.com to watch a short video.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on?
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Fletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow, what other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.